Thank you, Sam. An alcoholic. My name's Ronnie Simmons. Certainly appreciate being asked to come out here. I certainly don't expect it, and every time I get asked to go anywhere or do anything, I'm still amazed even today that the people would want to have me involved in anything they're doing that's going good. So I certainly appreciate the offer to come out. And I got sober on the 7th of October, 1988. That was the first shot at Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and I got sober on that day, and haven't had it necessary to pick up a drink from my very first meeting. And I don't say that to impress anybody or to make anybody think any more of me than somebody who's not gotten it on their first try. I truly do say it because if there is anybody in here who is just starting out and this is their first try, you don't ever have to drink again. You know, and the man said that to me early on, and I'm really glad that he did, because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with absolutely no idea whatsoever that I had a drinking problem. I really, truly didn't. I thought I had a getting in trouble problem when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, if I'd have bought into some of the things that I heard early on, and I might have given relapse a chance, I firmly believe people like me die from drinking. And I think I was one drink away from death when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I sat in a meeting out in Winchester, and the topic that night was relapse. And I'll never forget, there's probably 100, 150 people in the meeting, and the topic was relapse, and they were sharing about it. And the guy leading the meeting said, let's see a show of hands for all the people in the room that have had a relapse. And, I mean, 75% of the room, if not more, raised their hand. And I was 6 months sober thinking, well, you know, maybe it's not that bad. And I wanted to drink every minute of every day anyway, so what the heck. And a man, John Ricketts, said, can we see a show of hands all the people who had a relapse and didn't make it back? And I mean to tell you, here I sit 20-some years later, and I vividly remember where John was sitting and when he said it. And it made sense to me. Because I had been there a short period of time, and I sat around that room thinking, there's just in the short 6 months I've been coming to meetings, there's a lot of people I don't see anymore. There's a lot of people that used to be at this meeting that I don't see anymore. And it really stuck with me and it made an impression for me. And not to belabor the point, but if this is your first shot, you don't ever have to drink again. I have a home group. We meet on Saturday nights in Woodstock, the Pass It On group. Discussion meeting. We have a speaker second Saturday of every month. Greatest home group in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I firmly believe that. I also believe that if you don't believe your home group is the greatest one in Alcoholics Anonymous, you should do one of two things. You should switch home groups, or you should get active and make yours better. You know, it's easy to walk away, but maybe it's time to pick up and do a little more. So if your home group is not providing you with enough and don't feel that it's doing enough, just get active in that home group and people will follow. I firmly believe that. I have a sponsor today. I sponsor guys. I work the steps, and I believe in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also believe when I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm supposed to say yes if I can. Now, speaking's easy for me. I used to run around with Pete Nelson. People would ask me to speak. Pete would say, that boy go anywhere, I hear himself talk. And, I had to get Pete's name out there. You know, Pete used to run me up and down East Coast to speak at different places, and he'd always go with me. I don't know how he stood it. And afterwards, I'd go up to him. I'd say, Pete, how'd I do? And Pete say, I heard my name, you did just fine. So, you know, Pete's gone now, and he died with a long, long time of sobriety, and he's up there, but just in case he's listening, I'd like to get that out in front, you know. So, I've been blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't tell you the gifts, and I don't have enough time to even share part of what I've been given so freely in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's important for me to remember this about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so that's what I'm going to try to tell you in a general way, and not go into any gory details, but alcohol almost killed me, and Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And that's the short version of what my story is. But I was 11 years old in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and we were down there visiting a family, friends of my mom's and dad's. They went out for New Year's Eve. The babysitter let us drink a little bit of champagne. I don't know how much. I don't know what kind. But I know after a certain amount of it, the magic of alcohol happened. And at 11 years old, I fit in. I belonged and I was a part of. I don't know what we did. I don't know where we went. I couldn't tell you any more about that evening, other than eventually my mom and dad found out what had happened, and we got in trouble. And I can remember 11 years old being grounded for life, never to have fun again, all the toys put away, sitting on that couch thinking it was worth it. Even if I'm never allowed to smile again, to feel as good as I felt last night was well worth it. I did not become a daily drinker at the age of 11. That's not my story. But I remember the magic, and I couldn't wait for the opportunity to present itself again. And every time it presented itself from that time after, I took it. And most of the time, the magic happened. Most of the time, I fit in, I was a part of, and I belonged. And I enjoyed what booze did for me. It took away all my ambition. It took away all my fear. And it was truly the one thing in my life I could count on with any consistency. And, you know, I came from a good family. Never did without. My mom and dad were supportive. We lived in a small town. Everybody knew everybody. So the more I drank, the more my mom and dad knew about me. And eventually at 15, they had enough, and they told me I had to go somewhere else and live. And back then, you could throw your kids out at 15, you know. Not so much anymore. I tried, but back then you could. And so my mom and dad told me if I was going to live a life like that, I was going to have to go be on my own. So I did. And I got an apartment. I was dating a girl that was I had met at the skating rink. Back then, we used to go to the skating rink on Friday and Saturday night and get a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 and drink that real fast and put on roller skates. And What a recipe. And so that's what we did. And I met this girl down there at the skating rink, and she was blonde hair and blue eyes, and she was 19 years old, and I was kind of fond of her. And when I asked her to buy me a 6-pack of beer, and she said yes, I was madly in love. Hey, let me tell you, we're talking about falling in love. And so she had the car, and she'd drive me around and bought me beer, and I drank, and I just couldn't imagine anybody didn't want to be me. And I moved in with her. We got an apartment, and I got a job. I was working at the grocery store making 2 6-packs an hour, and I figured I had all I was ever going to need. I couldn't imagine what was going to be missing. And so we did that and had an apartment with a 6-pack in the fridge and a bottle of booze on top, and I just thought the world wanted to be me. I could not imagine life was ever going to get any better at 15, 16 years old sitting in this apartment. And so I took that, and I say, poor woman on a ride now that she never signed up for, I can assure you. And finally, when I was graduating high school, she had enough of a guy like me, and she went on her way. And what I had done was I had found every reason to drink and no reason not to. I was a baseball player. I was an athlete in school. I had a job, paid my own way, had a vehicle, and I gave up all that to keep on drinking. I quit school when I was 16 because it was in the way of my drinking. I liked to work because I was making that 2 6-packs an hour, and I liked to drink. And putting school in the middle of that was a big problem. So I dropped out of school and lived in a small town, and the athletic director came to me and said, hey, son, you know, you got a chance to play baseball. You need to come back to school. You need to finish up. So I did, and I went back to school, and I didn't do much more than play ball. And my sophomore year, I had a couple schools that were looking at me and doing some preliminary scouting. And by my senior year, I couldn't get a school to come look at me. Couldn't beg a coach to let me play. I had lost the desire to play. I'd lost the skill. And all I wanted to do was drink. And I got a chance. My dad got me over to a tryout to a small school over in West Virginia one scrimmage day. And I don't know how I put it together, but I had a good day. And we're walking out of there, and the athletic director and the dean of the school and the baseball coach, my dad, and they offered me a full ride to go play baseball at this school, full scholarship to go there and play ball and get an education. I remember walking off that baseball field thinking, how in the world did I get myself into this? How did I get into this? The last thing I want to do is go to school. How am I going to get out of this? Here I am trapped. And we walked up over this hill, and there was two guys sitting on a Volkswagen Bug, drinking a Miller Genuine Draft out of the bottle. And the coach and the athletic director and the dean walked right past him. Nobody said a word to him. And I knew I wanted to go to college. I was certain of it. Because every time I sat on the hood of a car drinking a bottle of booze and authority came by, I got in trouble. I got told to put it away, or I got locked up, or I got something happened to me bad. But here was heaven on earth. You could sit on the hood of a car and drink a bottle of booze in front of the authority, and nobody cared. So I couldn't wait to go to school. And I went back home for that last summer before I went to school, and I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, and got locked up. And they let me out of jail to go to school on the terms that I was going to go to school. And my mom and dad took me over to West Virginia to this college and dropped me off. And I can remember sitting in that room making the decision for the first time that I wasn't going to drink anymore. I was going to get sober. I was going to get my life together. I was going to take advantage of the situation. I was going to play ball. I was going to make up for all my mistakes. I was going to make right with my mom and dad. And I decided I wasn't going to drink. And I sat in that room that night, and my roommate was another ball player, and he came in, introduced himself, and introduced his girlfriend, and he said, "We're going down to the pub to have a drink. You want to go along?" And I said, "I don't drink." And he said, "Okay," and off he went. And I sat there, day one of sobriety. And he came back a couple hours later, same girl he left with, no police, no handcuffs, same clothes he had on when he left. And I thought, well, where in the heck did he go drinking at? And, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense to a guy like me. And the next night when he said, "My girlfriend and I are going down to the pub, do you want to go have a drink?" I said, "Yes." Yeah, I thought if there was a safe place like that to drink, I should take advantage of it. And he came back that night with his girlfriend, fully dressed, but carrying me half naked, blood coming out of me, you know. It's just the way I drank. It's just what I did. And 3 months later, I got thrown out of school and got my scholarship voided because I couldn't stop drinking. It's all I wanted to do. It was the only thing that mattered to me. And I came back home and I blamed the dean and I blamed the coach and I blamed everybody, the teachers and everybody but me. And I told my mom and dad how it wasn't fair and how it was everybody's fault but mine. And mom and dad told me there was nothing they could do to help me. And so off I went doing my thing. And I drank for another couple, probably another year, year and a half with some friends of mine. And we got an apartment. I remember when we were working night shift together and we started looking for an apartment. And we found this apartment for a couple $100 a month. And it was right in the middle of town. It was a block away from the liquor store. It was 2 blocks away from where they sold the cheap beer. It was only about a mile away from where we were working. And it was literally right across the street from the police station. And everything I was going to need for the next 3 or 4 months was in walking distance. And so we took this apartment and took this job, and we were drinking and carrying on. And we were working night shift, so we'd get off work in the morning, and I'd get beer and start drinking. And we had 13-inch black and white TV on with rabbit ears, and I'd watch Phil Donahue. And it was the only thing on. And it was over at 10 o'clock and the liquor store opened. So the Phil Donahue show would end and I'd walk up to the liquor store. And there was three winos walking around the liquor store every morning waiting for it to open. Skippy Dobbs and Bill Thompson. And I'd walk around with them, wait for them to unlock the doors, and we'd go in and get our bottle and walk back. And I'd go up to my apartment and they'd go back behind the place I was living. And I'd think to myself, if those guys could just catch a break, they could get their lives together. I found out all about sponsorship long before Alcoholics Anonymous. Because after I stopped paying rent and I had nowhere to go, Skippy Dobbs and Bill Thompson started sponsoring me. And they taught me how to live on the streets. And they taught me how to get drunk off of lemon extracts and Robitussin cough syrup. And they taught me it was easier to steal that stuff than it was a bottle of wine any day. And so I hung out with these guys and I drank with these guys. And at the very end, you know, I remember drinking Sterno and canned heat and cooking fish over chicken wire on a barrel. And I remember thinking, who wouldn't want to be me? You know, didn't have to work anymore, didn't have the burden of a job, didn't have to pay rent. And I just sat around and drank cheap wine all day long. And it wasn't so bad. And I was convinced it wasn't so bad. And my last drink came one night. My friend that I was living with, who I used to help sometimes pay the rent with, had a party and didn't invite me in that apartment. So I went up to the party, and one thing led to another, and the police wound up coming. And I was sitting at the table, and I took a last drink of a bottle, and they put the handcuffs on me and put me down the steps and into the car and put me into a jail cell. Now, believe me, I had no idea that was my last drink. I had no idea at that point I even had a drinking problem. And I wound up locked up in this jail for the umpteenth time with nobody to call and nowhere to go and everybody to blame. And my lawyer came to see me and he said, I really don't know what we're going to do this time. He said, you've been locked up so many times. He said, I'm not sure I can get you out of this one. He said, you're probably going to wind up doing a year. And I said to Phil, I said, I don't care what it takes. Money is no object. You need to get me out of here. Now, when I say money's no object, we were panhandling about $3 a day for Wild Irish Rose back then. So I don't know how long it was going to take me to panhandle to pay that lawyer to get me out of jail, but it was going to be a while. And Phil had a look on his face that I know none of you can relate to, but he really didn't understand what I was saying. And he walked away from me, and I sat in that jail cell thinking, you know what? I need to get out of here. I got to get out of here. And he came back, and he said, we got an idea. We got a plan. We're going to take you in front of the judge. We're going to tell him that you're going down to a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center in Winchester, and we'll get him to postpone the charges pending that. And I thought, well, that'll never happen. I said, I'm not going to a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. I don't even do drugs. And there was no way I was going to, you know, degrade myself to go to such a facility. And, just no way. And I told Phil, I said, I'll do the year. And he had that same look on his face, and he walked away from me. And I sat there thinking, you know what? A year won't be that bad. With my skills, I'll be running this place in a year. I'll have a little, you know, just that grandiosity was just unbelievable. And I figured, you know what? Just a matter of time, I'll have this place running, people catering to me, and I'll just do my year and get it over with. And then what happened was the math on doing a year and drinking versus 30 days and drinking kicked in. And I figured, you know what? If I just do that treatment center, 30 days, I'll be done. And I can go back to living the way I want to live and doing the things I wanted to do. So Phil came back, and I said, all right, Phil. I said, go ahead and sign me up for that rehab thing. I said, tell him I'll be down in a couple weeks, and we'll get started on that. Phil said, it's not going to work that way. He said, we're going to go from here to there. And I said, Phil, there's no way I can go from here to there. I said, I've got far too many loose ends to tie up before I can do that. And Phil said, you're homeless. I said, you don't have a job. I said, your family won't talk to you. What loose ends could you possibly have to tie up? And see, what Phil didn't understand, and I'm guessing a few of you might, is if I could have got out of there long enough to get down to the 7-Eleven, get one more bottle of Wild Irish Rose, sneak around the back of that store and drink the top just that much out of it, the magic would happen. It happened when I was 11 years old in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And all my problems would disappear. And I'd fit in, I'd be part of, and I'd belong. I just needed one more bottle to make it all go away. And I thank God every day that Phil didn't understand that. Because if they'd let me out for one more drink, I think it would have killed me. And they took me down to this treatment center, and they walked me in the front door. And I mean this beast of a man come walking down the hall. I mean, he was, my God, he had to be 6 foot tall, 200 pounds. And I'm about 5 foot four, about 97 pounds. And he introduced himself as Jonathan, and I went to try to shake his hand, and he said, we don't shake hands here, we give hugs. And he gave this big hug. And I turned to those sheriffs, and I said, you guys can take me back now. And I said, ain't no way I'm staying here, grown men hugging each other. And they kept me in that treatment center and put me upstairs, and they brought me down. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my entire net worth I brought with me. I was 97 pounds soaking wet. I had a pair of torn blue jeans on, flip-flops. I was wearing a jail shirt, and I had a spare jail shirt stuffed into a red duffel bag. That was my entire net worth when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was all that I had left when I got here. And they took me upstairs and put me in that room. And the next morning, they brought me down for breakfast. It was biscuits and donuts and eggs and bacon and fruit and everything. And I went upstairs and I got that duffel bag and I was filling it up, putting the bread and the donuts and the bananas in that duffel bag. They brought us down for lunch and it was chicken and hamburgers and hot dogs everywhere. And the only thing I was thinking is I got to get another duffel bag. I got to get a bigger duffel bag. And I was all about the food they were serving in that warm room and I took a shower and I was kind of into this treatment center thing until they took me to Alcoholics Anonymous. My very first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, they took me to the Quaker House, and there was three pews that lead down to the center of the room where the table was. And, of course, I went in and made a hard left on that first set of pews up there in the back corner, away from everybody. I didn't want anything to do. Didn't know why I was here. Didn't know what was getting ready to happen. And they opened up the meeting, and they said, tonight we're on the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight we're on the third step. And I sat there, and I counted those pews. One, two, three. I wasn't sure what happened to you if you were on the third step at your first meeting, but I was unwilling to find out, so I scurried on down to the next pew, just in case. Just in case. I didn't know what was getting ready to happen. And those guys started talking about God, and I was done. As soon as I heard it the first, that was it. I shut everything else out because the things that happened to a guy like me would have never happened if there was a God. And I certainly wouldn't have wound up in a place like this with people like you. And I wanted nothing to do with God. And I went back to the treatment center and I told the lady there, I said, I'm not going to go to those meetings anymore. There is no God. Look, well, look at my life. Look at the things that have happened to me. If you only knew what I had been through. And here I sit and they want to talk about God. And she said, you don't have any choice. You have to go to those meetings. So the next week when I went back, they were on the first step. It was a 1-2-3 meeting. They'd rotate back around. They were on the first step. And I was sitting there and they said, they were on the first step, and a guy named Tom said that he couldn't mow the grass without a six-pack of beer. And it was the first thing I heard in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that made sense. I got it. And I didn't understand who would want to mow the grass without a six-pack of beer. You know, everything I did, I wanted to do with a six-pack of beer. And when he said that, it made sense to me. And that Friday night, they took us to that meeting in Winchester, and at that meeting, they handed out chips. Halfway through the meeting, they stopped the meeting and they said, we hand out chips for various lengths of sobriety. And there was about 150 people in that meeting back then. And he says, anybody in here got 30 days of sobriety? And a couple guys stood up and went and got chips, and that room erupted. There was an excitement in that room that I hadn't felt in years. I was sold on Alcoholics Anonymous. The enthusiasm and the passion and the clapping and the whistling and the stomping, man, I wanted a 30-day chip more than I wanted anything. I couldn't wait to get my 30-day chip. I was sucked into Alcoholics Anonymous. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. I couldn't get enough of that clapping and cheering. I could not wait to get my 30-day chip. Now, granted, I was locked up, so I had a good shot at it. But I still wanted one. I was still pretty darn excited about getting one. And so I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous in this treatment center with every intention of drinking when I got out. Every intention of just giving this a little bit of time, getting the police off my back, and going back to drinking. I never had a moment's thought in that treatment center about any long-term sobriety, any commitment whatsoever to Alcoholics Anonymous, past that 30-day chip. Now, granted, I was all about getting clapped for, and I was going to do that. But then they handed out chips for like 6 and 9 months and a year. I knew it was all for show at that point. Nobody stays sober that long, you know. I mean, maybe 30 days. Maybe they got a 2-month treatment center or somebody did 60 days, but whatever. You know, I thought it was all fluff after that. And so I got ready to finish up my treatment center, and something happened one day in that treatment center, and I stand before you with a good bit of distance between that treatment center day and today, and I can vividly remember it happening. And we were eating lunch, and I think maybe I hunched over my food a little bit and might have held a fork in a stabbing position, I'm not quite sure. But a lady named Treva put her hand on my back. And she said, it's okay, son. Nobody will take it from you here. And it may not mean anything to anybody, but it meant something to me. And it was a soft touch. And she told me I was going to be all right. And I didn't know what that meant, but I ate a piece of chicken with a little bit of peace. And I never forgot that. And it meant so much to me. And when I got out of that treatment center, I knew I'd drink again. I was certain of it. But I heard these things in those meetings and in that treatment center about going to 90 meetings in 90 days and getting a sponsor and not drinking no matter what and going to these meetings. So I figured, you know, I really didn't want to go back to jail. I knew the police would be watching me. I'm from a small town anyways. I figured I got to put a little bit of time at least before I get in trouble again so I don't have to go straight to jail. So I figured I'd go to these meetings. And then I figured if I'm going to go to these meetings, I might as well get a sponsor. And a guy like me, if I'm going to get a sponsor, I might as well get the president to sponsor me. So there was this guy out in Winchester, Johnny Welch. He's still alive. He's out there And Johnny never told me he was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous, but Johnny never told me he wasn't the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Johnny was always telling people what to do, so I just assumed he was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I figured I'd ask Johnny to sponsor me. And Johnny said he'd sponsor me. And so he told me what meetings I had to go to, and Johnny went to those meetings, and I'd go sit with Johnny at these meetings. And every day, the only hour of peace I got in my day was at those meetings. The other 23, I had a back-breaking compulsion to drink. I woke up with it, and I went to sleep with it. I didn't think it would ever leave. But for that 1 hour a day, when I sat in the meeting next to Johnny, I didn't want to drink as bad. So I knew the smartest thing I could possibly do is go to a meeting every night. So I did. And one night, John Ricketts, the man I mentioned early on, said, "I've been making coffee at this meeting for too long. If somebody don't take the key, there won't be any coffee next week." And he put it on the table. And Johnny grabbed that key. And I thought, well, that's good. Johnny's going to make coffee out here on Monday night. That was my first service position in Alcoholics Anonymous. Johnny handed me that key and he said, "Go talk to Mr. Ricketts and find out how to make the coffee." I said, "Johnny, I can't make coffee. I live 30 miles from here." I said, "I can't get out here to make the coffee." Johnny said, "I suggest you leave your house at 6 o'clock. And so I got my first coffee position. And you know what happened for me? It took me about 2 or 3 weeks, and I finally got that meeting straightened out. I finally got that coffee right. I finally got those chairs lined up right. I got the creamer beside the sugar and not the sugar beside the creamer, and I got it all right. Finally got that. And I was wondering how it even survived without me taking charge of it. You know? Got the literature rack straightened out. And you know what I'm trying to tell you is I took a passion and a love for that home group. And I was a part of something, and it mattered, and they were counting on me. So if you're not holding a service position, or you're sponsoring guys that aren't holding a service position, help them out. Do them a favor. Do them a favor. Because it was a big favor for me. I had a commitment. I had somewhere to be. No matter how bad I wanted to drink all day Monday, I couldn't. Because AA would fail if I didn't show up for that coffee. And I couldn't let that happen. Now you know. So it was the one day I knew I had to be somewhere. So if you're not getting your guys to do that type of service work, do them a favor. Get them a key. Because it made a big difference for a guy like me. And I made coffee out there for quite a while, and Johnny sponsored me for a little bit. And you know, I did everything possibly wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous except pick up a drink. And Johnny used to tell me I could do anything I wanted to do in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I was willing to pay the extreme right or the extreme left of my consequences. And so what happened to me over the years is my desire to pay those extremes kind of moved into the middle. But early on, I was willing to pay some extreme consequences. And I did a lot of things that I shouldn't have done in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd always ask Johnny, "Am I doing okay?" And Johnny would say, "I don't see a toe tag yet." You know, so if you ain't dead, there's still hope. And that was kind of what he got into me. And, you know, I did a lot of stuff, and I was 19 years old when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there's a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but 20 couple years ago, there wasn't anybody 19 but me. And we used to go get coffee and eat dinner on Friday night, and I can remember sitting up at that Shoney's with Everett and Janie and Johnny and Larry and all those people. They must have been 100 years old each. And I can remember thinking, this is what my life has come to. Oh, I can't believe it. This is everything I got to look forward to. And I'd sit there in that restaurant with those guys and think life had literally come to an end. And I tell you, a year later, I was living up in New York, and I missed that restaurant so bad I drove back just to eat dinner with those guys. I drove 400 miles on a Friday night to speed of sound because I missed being there. I missed sitting at that Shoney's eating that dinner with those guys on Friday night. Because it mattered to me. Certain things started to matter. People started to matter. Places started to matter. And I wanted to be part of something. I met wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I tell you I got sober on the shoulders of giants, make no mistake, that's exactly what I mean. Now, a lot of what you'll hear me say, somebody else said long before me. So anything I say up here isn't, you know, the gospel according to Ronnie. I don't make any of the rules or the bylaws for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I tell you, the people that guided me through Alcoholics Anonymous to where I am today, wonderful people. And Johnny, after a few months of sponsoring me, some people hadn't paid me for some work I had done, and I had been complaining about it quite a bit. And finally, I stopped complaining about it. And Johnny asked me, whatever happened with those people that didn't pay you for that work you did? I saw I burned that garage down. Johnny didn't think that was the right solution. And so Johnny said, you know, people like you make people like me crazy. And so after he got done yelling at me for a while and telling me I was going to have to repay those people and fix that garage again, he told me I had to find another sponsor, which may sound mean and nasty and brutal, but that's the way Johnny is. And I'm okay with that today because it was time. It was time. And Johnny said he would help me find somebody else to sponsor me. And remained friends with me even through the day, never turned his back on me, but knew he couldn't help a guy like me. And so he took me over to, and I had met Janie Whitaker by then. I was going with Janie a lot of different places. So I was hanging out at Janie's house one evening, and there was this guy sitting in the chair against the wall, and he had side of his glasses was broken off, and they were all cocked sideways, and he's reading this book, and I was telling Janie about somebody else had done me wrong or cheated me out of something, how the world wasn't a fair place, and, you know, poor, poor me. And this guy pipes up. He says, sounds to me like the problem's you. And he gets up and leaves. Well, I figured he must have had about, like, 2 days of sobriety, so I figured I'd let him slide. So out the door he goes. I said to Janie, I said, who is that guy and what's wrong with him? And she said, oh, that's Larry Goodyear. He lives across the street there. She said, he'd be a good guy to sponsor you. I started laughing. I said, some guy thinks the problem is me. It's not going to be a good guy to sponsor me. I'll tell you that right now. That's a bad idea. And she said, no, he's been sober 16 years. He'd be a good guy to sponsor you. And so I started seeing Larry around, and eventually I asked him to sponsor me. And, you know, when I tell you that that man literally saved my life, I am truly, truly telling you, that man saved my life. Had he not taken the time to raise this 19-year-old kid in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have died from drinking. I'm convinced of that. This man did more for me in the next 16 years I spent beside his side than I think anybody could ever possibly do for another human being. That man had a way of making you feel like you were the only guy in the room, like you were the most important, special guy in there, and your problem was the biggest problem known to man. And if you were truly wanting to do something about that problem, he would do anything it took to help you solve it. No matter how late at night you wanted to talk, no matter how early in the morning you wanted to talk, no matter what it took, that man was for you and he was on your side. And you could walk into a room and just being with him made you feel important. Just being with him made you feel special. And you know, he made me want to become a good person. You know, Larry would say to me early on, he said, there will come a time, he said, you'll be a good father. You'll be a good husband. Be a good employee. I said, I got no wife, no kids, no job. I said, there would become a time. And little did I know, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous afforded me the opportunity to become a good father and a good husband and a good employee and a good son and a good friend. I had none of those abilities when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not have been successful in anything I did. I heard a man talking from the podium the other month, and he said, all the tragic things in my life were going to happen, whether I was drunk or sober. But all the good things that have happened didn't have a chance if I didn't get sober. And when he said that, it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to me. Guys like me don't ever have anything good happen when they're drinking. It just doesn't have the opportunity. And had I not got active in Alcoholics Anonymous, had Larry not taken the time to guide me through those steps, had he not taken the time to help me become the person I am today, I wouldn't have had a chance of anything good happening in my life. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't miss him more than anything. There's not a person that I look up to more than that man in my life. And there's probably not one single thing that I'm more grateful for than that man being in my life. You know, I remember Larry he called me up. I was living in Manassas at the time, and he called me up and he said, I need you to come by the house. And, you know, somehow that you really don't want to go by the house. And I was like a little kid again. I stopped at the motorcycle shop. I was riding my bike. And I stopped in there, and I was walking around, looking at different things, thinking about that. And I figured if I could just stay in here forever, then I don't have to go to his house, and I don't have to hear the bad news. Finally, they said, hey, man, we're trying to close up the shop. So I left and I went to his house, And he told me, you know, you see, he got back from the doctor and he had the cancer and wasn't going to be good. And I was devastated. I mean, I just couldn't even process it. And so I got to spend the next 2 years with him as he fought this battle. And, you know, what a gift. What a gift for this kid who didn't have time or energy for anybody or anything. To have somebody in their life that wanted them there and I wanted to be with. So I got to spend that time with him. And there was a lot of people that got to spend time with him. And we took care of him. And he was tied to an oxygen tube there at the end. And 2005 World Convention was up in Toronto. My friend David over there and Janie and Shane and I and the guy that was taking care of Larry, we got an RV and got his oxygen generator and put it in the RV. And we took him to Toronto to the World Convention. I had been to a couple, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world, man. World Convention is just, it's uncomparable to anything. And I figured I owed it to Larry. You know, the guy who did everything for me. I know he's not going to make it. I'm going to take him up there and show him a great time. We're going to go to great dinners. He's going to go to the World Convention. He's going to see 50,000 people. He's going to hold hands and do the Lord's Prayer. You know, what a great guy I am for doing this for Larry. And so off we go. And he went in the hospital right before we were supposed to leave. He went back in the hospital. And he struggled with his lungs and everything. And he said, I just don't think I can get strong enough to go, Ronnie. I don't think I can do it. And I said, I understand. I said, if you can, we should go. I said, what are you going to do? You're going to buy yourself a couple more days. I said, let's go in the RV. Let's have a good time. Let's go up. You'll be with Janie and Debbie and David and Shane and I. And we'll have a good time. And his daughter, he had two daughters at the time. And they said, you know, we're really nervous about sending our dad up there. Really nervous. And I said to Scarlett, we're staying beside that RV. And I said, if he doesn't make it back, I promise I'll bring him home. Promise I'll bring him home. So we went to Canada, and we did this trip, and took him around, and had a great time at the convention. And he just never had that big smile on his face. I felt like I had failed him. I wanted him to have fun. He just never seemed to be happy up there. And I don't know what was wrong. And no matter how hard I tried, no matter how big of a event we went to or what type of dinner we went out to, he just didn't ever seem to be really happy. And I felt like I let him down. We were coming home from there, and we stopped at this truck stop. And it's a buffet truck stop in the middle of somewhere up in upstate New York somewhere. And we were sitting there eating, and he had biscuit and gravy covered from all over his face, and he was just smiling and laughing. He was having the time of his life. He had the cook came out, and he's clapping for the cook, and it was just amazing to watch. And I don't know what happened, but he was just having a great time. And so we packed him up, brought him home, and a couple days later, I had my son and my wife and a friend of my nephew. We were at King's Dominion for my son's 12th birthday. We had taken him up there for his 12th birthday. And I got a phone call, and they said, you need to come home. And I said to my kids, I said, I got to go home. I said, you know, Larry's not going to make it. And my son, 12 years old at King's Dominion, said, okay, let's go. No hesitation. No roller coaster, no poor me, no what about my birthday. Let's go. Because Larry had that type of impact on my son. So he gets in the car, and off we go. I'm driving home, and I get the call to take my time because he's passed. And his daughter called and said, but take your time. We won't move him until you get here. Now think about that. That's your dad. He's passed away at home where he wanted to. And you're willing to hold up the hospice call to come get him so some drunk 19-year-old kid off the street, good for nothing, can spend another hour driving home to see him laying in that bed. Think about that. Sacrifice. But they knew that that's the way the relationship I had with this human being. So I drove home, and I walked in his room, and he was in the bed, and they said, you can have some time with him. So I said my piece, and my son came in, held my hand, said his piece to Larry, and we went about and had the service. And it was just a wonderful experience, you know, just to have that in my life and to be part of that. And what a gift in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, what a gift. Unable to participate in life is what I was when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And here I sat and had a relationship with another human being that mattered to him and to me. You know, Larry got hit by a dump truck one time, and he wound up in the emergency room in a coma. And he was in a coma for like 20 days. And so I was sitting by his bedside during this process, and I figured since he was in a coma, it would be a good time to knock out that fifth step. So I went ahead and got that taken care of. And when he came out of the coma, well, let me backtrack just a bit here. So when I got the call that he had been hit, I jumped in the car. I was in Culpeper over here working, heading to Winchester. I was flying at the speed of sound over there. And something came over me, and I realized that I was going to wind up having an accident if I didn't slow down. So I did, and something came over me, and I realized that if I got there, I got there. And if I didn't, I didn't. It was okay. It was okay. And so when I got there, he was in this coma, and he came out of the coma 20 couple days later, and I was telling him the story about coming across there. And he said to me, he said, it wouldn't have mattered if I would have died. He said, there's nothing left to be said. He said, it's all good. And I don't know how he knew that I had that come over me, but when he shared with that, you know, he also told me, I said, well, Larry, I said, it's important to me that you know how much that you mean to me and how much I love you. And he said, I do know that. He said, know this. He said, there's nothing you could ever do that would make me love you more. There's nothing you could ever do that would make me love you less. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that. And I was truly blessed to have that man in my life for that period of time. And I often wonder what I would consider any success in Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. And I know truly what it would be, is to have another human being feel for me the way I felt for him. Because I believe that would be the true success. So, you know, Larry was a true inspiration, obviously, with what I shared with you. And great people like him, Shoulders of Giants that I talk about. You know, I spent time with Pete Nelson up there in Northern Virginia and ran around with him. And I was truly blessed. I learned more from that Manassas group about what a home group was than I've ever learned anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. That Manassas Baptist group, when Pete was alive, and Pinky and John Bolton and Huey and those guys, that was a group of men that cared about Alcoholics Anonymous and cared about members in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw that. I was in that group for a couple months, and Pete said, we'll pick you up at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to a funeral. I said, I don't even know that guy. He said, it doesn't matter. Put on a suit. We'll pick you up at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I did. And I went and I did everything they did. And I've always been a follower in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in that. You know, when I got here, they said, if you want what we have, do what we do. So I find people in Alcoholics Anonymous who've got what I want, and I do what they do. And I do it as it works for me. And I suggest that to anybody. I suggest that to anybody. Find people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have something you want and figure out how they got it and do what they do. That's the crucial part. Everybody wants to take the shortcut today. You know, I sponsor guys in Alcoholics Anonymous that want to go 2 meetings a week. They don't want to participate. Don't want to get a home group. Say, I don't know how you expect to get where we are if you don't do what we did. You know, I got guys, I tell them all the time. They say, well, you know, I can only make it this time. I can only go to that time. And I said, you know, the problem with cutting back on meetings, you know, if you start with 5 and you cut back to 3 and you cut back to 1, the big problem with getting to 1 is anytime you cut back, it is significant. If you're at 1 a week and you cut back, it gets significant fast. So I got to be careful I don't ever wind up in that situation. So that's why I keep a home group and I keep an active participation in several different groups. And it's important to me. And one thing that's real important to me, and I know I've belabored the point, but I thank God Larry didn't stop going to meetings. And I thank God Pete didn't stop going to meetings. And I thank God Huey didn't stop going to meetings. Because had any of those guys stopped going to meetings, I would have never met them. I'd never been able to be part of their life. And I'd have never learned from them. And then, you know, as I share about being a good father and a good husband and a good son, I tell you about my grandmother. And my grandfather died when I was 18 years old. And my mom yelled out the back to tell me to come inside. And I came in there and she said, your grandfather passed away. We need to go to New York. My 18th birthday. And I thought, I got 2 kegs of beer coming down to the skating rink. I'm not going to New York for no funeral, that's for sure. And I didn't go to my grandfather's funeral. And a couple years later, I got sober. And I decided I was going to build a relationship with my grandmother, one that I didn't have. And it started with a simple phone call on Sunday. And I'd call her up, talk to her for a few minutes about the weather and whatever else. And back then, you paid for long distance, and my grandmother wouldn't waste a nickel on anything. So it was a short conversation. We talked about the weather and hang up. And after a while, she was up there by herself, and I was going to retreats up there. And I'd stop and see her twice a year, and I realized that I should try to talk her into coming to Virginia. So So we did. And we talked her coming to Virginia, and we got her house. We brought her down there. She spent 5 years active with me and my family and my mom. And she had probably the best 5 years she had had in the past 30. And she was happy. She was content. And I talk about that because it was part of my amends process. It was my amends for being a selfish 18-year-old kid and not knowing that I should go to a funeral. And at the end, my grandmother got the cancer. And I sat with her as she was passing away. And my mom called me in the middle of the night. And she said, I need your help to get Nana from her bed to the hospice bed. And so I went down. She lived right down the hill from me. And I went down and I picked my grandmother up and I put her into the hospice bed. And I knew she'd never get out again. What a gift. What a gift to be present and accountable for that. To be part of that. To have that as part of my story. As something I can look back on. As opposed to turn around to my mom as her dad passed away. And say, I'm not going to New York. So those are the type of things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. All because people taught me right from wrong. All because people took the time to show me and guide me through those steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I work the steps and I believe in the steps. And if you're not working the steps, unfortunately, I believe you're shortchanging yourself. Because magic happens in those steps. And I'll share with you one story that happened for me. As I was working through those steps, I made a ninth step amends. And I went to a lady's house to repay some money. And I knocked on the door and she opened the door. And I handed her a bag of money. And she said, what's this? And I explained the situation. And she handed me that money back and she said, I wouldn't take that. She said, any money that comes from you, somebody got hurt on the other end for. She shut the door in my face. And I walked off that porch and you know what I realized? She was 100% right. The person she knew, rest assured, if he had a bag full of money, somebody got hurt on the other end for it. But I also realized I wasn't that man anymore. I'm not the man I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got in my car and I drove to my sponsor's house and I told him, I'm not that guy anymore. This is good, clean money. I work for this money. And it's the right thing to do. And I'm not that man anymore. Had I not walked through those steps, had I not been willing to make that amends, maybe I wouldn't have felt that peace inside of me. Maybe I wouldn't have walked off that step knowing I'm not the man I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. Had I not walked through those steps, maybe I wouldn't have carried my grandmother to her hospice bed. And I would have known I wasn't the man I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when people come to me in need and desire to get better in Alcoholics Anonymous, had I not learned from those people before me, maybe I wouldn't realize that maybe they just need somebody to talk to for a little bit. Maybe they just need somebody to tell them they can become better. Maybe they just need somebody to guide them through that step to make that amends or to find God or whatever the next thing is in their path. You know, I don't claim to have saved anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't claim to have any ability to do that. But all I can do is share with you and share with others the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous and how it's happened for me. And that's what's happened throughout my sobriety. No matter where I've lived, no matter what group I've run with, no matter what I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've stayed active and I've seen magic happen. I've seen wonderful things happen. I've seen lives change in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'll share with you towards the end here, you know, a little bit about my own personal family. You know, my wife is in recovery, and I met her 20-some years ago, and we knew each other throughout Alcoholics Anonymous. We wound up getting married, and we had some tragedy strike into our family. My son got hurt under some circumstances, and I coped with it in one way, and she coped with it by going back out. And we spent 6 years with her back out there with a significantly heavy problem, and I really thought she would die. I really thought she was going to die. And there was nothing I could do. And the reason I'm bringing this up is just to share with you just a little bit about that powerlessness of people, places, and things. And also, you know, in case you're struggling with something like this, I want to give a little bit of hope back too. Because we spent 6 years, and she struggled through that addiction. And at the very end, she was at her bottom when my grandmother passed away. And my grandmother wanted to be buried in New York. So we had her body taken up to New York, and I got my kids together and my dog together and my mom and them. We were going up to New York to bury my grandmother. And my wife was all strung out. And I stood there as she laid in that bed. And she said, leave the dog behind, leave the dog behind. And I said, you can't even take care of a dog. And you'll probably be dead when I get home. And I got in the car and I went to New York. And when I got home, she was strung out in the hospital. And I was done. I was ready to give up. And I made a few more calls, and we got her into a treatment center and took her down to a treatment center and got her cleaned up and off the medication and focused in on recovery. And I met with her and the counselor, and I said, you know what, I'm willing to do anything if it's about sobriety. I said, and I'll hang in there and I'll stick in there if we're going to get sober and stay sober. But if we're not, I'm done. And you can have what's yours and you can go about your way. But I can't watch you kill yourself anymore. And so she's been able to put together a wonderful program, and she works her own program. And we have been able to figure out that I actually know nothing, which is a good thing. And so she goes and does her program, and I go and do mine. And she's been able to put together some time here. And it's all about just, you know, being powerlessness. It's being power, you know, I was powerlessness over that situation, and I had to just let her find her way. And it's probably one of the most difficult things that I think we deal with in Alcoholics Anonymous is watching people suffer, especially people we love. And sometimes we just have to. You know, I was telling you about that boy that was 12 years old holding my hand. He's struggling now too. And we had to put him into a rehab back in October. Hasn't really taken. He's back into a mental facility tonight. And there's nothing I can do except love him and be there when he comes out. You know? So I truly believe that God gives us nothing more than we can handle. I believe everything that's put in our path is put there for a reason. And I think it's important that we never give up on anyone or anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're struggling or you know somebody that's struggling, don't give up. Don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. You know, I believe in the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly do. It's affected me in a great way, and I hope it's done the same for you. Thanks, Sam, for inviting me out. Thank everybody for sticking around. And I always like to end with a little story I heard a guy talk about. And he said this little girl, she went to Europe. And while she was in Europe, she visited all the cathedrals. And when she got home, the man said to the little girl, what did you see while you were in Europe? And she said, I saw the saints. And the man said, who are the saints? And the little girl, in her innocence, said, the saints are the ones that let the light in. And I say to you, in my innocence, you're the ones that let the light in for me. The moment I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was freely given that light. Thank you.